Hi, I'm Andy McCluskey. I lead, sing and play bass guitar.
I am Paul Humphreys. I play keyboards mainly and a little bit of singing. And we are from Orchestral Maneuvers in the Dark.
And we are here in Fredrik's lovely apartment in Stockholm.
And you're so very, very welcome.
Thank you.
Thanks for coming.
Nice to be here.
The pandemic was a really dark time, but at least we got a new OMD record, mm-hmm. thanks to the pandemic. Or is that how it happened?
Yeah, basically.
Yeah, kind of, yeah.
There was nothing else to do. We finished a big tour in February 2020, and then boom, that was it, lockdown. And
I was stuck in France.
Yeah, Paul was stuck in... Not a bad place to be stuck,
yeah, south
to be
of
honest.
France.
South of France. I was stuck on Merseyside. and, I mean, it was like being a teenager again when there was only three channels on the TV and my mother was watching something I hated. So I would go to my room and I would do a painting or write music. And that's what it was like. There was nothing else to do. So I sat down in front of my computer and just went, right, I've got stuff in here that I haven't finished. Now is the time to start finishing it and see what we can make. And so I just started looking up. There's quite a few things that Paul had given me chords and pieces for that I started working on. And there was just, that's it, just... Because, you know, we're both in our 60s now. We were thinking it maybe it'd be time to slow down and smell the roses that we've planted in the 40-odd years of the success of the band.
Yeah, and become a little less busy, you know.
But... There was nothing to do in COVID, so I started writing and Paul just kept moving house. Oh, and making babies.
And making babies and also feeding Andy some things. I had a good chance to go through all my archives and my hard drives of ideas, so I was sending Andy stuff
as well.
You
became a father again?
I became a father again, yeah. So I've got a 32-year-old and now almost 3-year-old.
Congratulations.
Thank you. Lockdown baby.
And you named your 14th album Bauhaus Staircase after a painting by Oskar Schlemmer, an artist who actually designed the Bauhaus logo.
Mm-hmm.
And I think his paintings were burned by the Nazis. Or at least they were part of this exhibition of degenerate art.
Degenerate, yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, totalitarian regimes don't like art. Because they don't understand it.
They're threatened by it.
They can't control it. Yeah, they're threatened by it. So, the Bauhaus was effectively shut down in 1933 by the Nazis. And I'm not saying that that modern governments are like the Nazis, but certainly there was an element in the UK when they were paying furlough money to everybody who had a job, but they wouldn't give any money to anybody in the creative industries. No artists,
arts,
no musicians,
nothing.
No actors, no singers, and none of the people who worked in the tech side of those. So, in fact, there was an infamous poster made by our government of a dancer. So, you know, today she's a ballet dancer. Next year she could be an IT expert, basically saying creative is a waste of time. So yeah. It seemed appropriate during lockdown when we felt undervalued and under attack by our governments to celebrate the power and the creativity and the soul feeding of great art. And so kind of Bauhaus became a metaphor for where my head was at.
And the staircase in itself kind of becomes a metaphor for like the human spirit rising above problems. Mm-hmm. And then in the last verse, what you sing sounds like almost a protest song against neo-fascism. You sing, never beg, nor kneel, or pray.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, you know, this is somebody who also, you know, my politics are very, shall we say, liberal left. And I'm an atheist as well, so I don't pray. it was ticking a lot of my personal boxes.
My old history teacher in high school used to say that he was sure that we would get to experience living in a dictatorship sometime in our lives. And that mm-hmm. sounded insane when he told us that in the early 90s.
Yeah,
but
and
it could happen.
You know, it doesn't seem that far-fetched anymore.
No, the rise of Trump. You know, Trump could end up being a dictator in America if he manages to get in.
Yeah.
It will be the death of democracy in America if he can possibly manage to do it. He will do it. You know,
Putin is in Ukraine. Is you know started a very. I never thought at my age that I would see major armed conflict in Europe again. That's very sad. And. And, you know, the Middle East, the Israeli-Palestinian issue remains unresolved after whatever it is, 60-odd years now. It's
and there's a general rise of the far right across the globe, you know, certainly in Europe as well. It's very worrying.
We're getting extreme. I mean, listen, it's not 1940 yet.
Yet, yeah.
On the title track, you also sing that you need to dance in a triad ballet.
Mm-hmm.
The triadic ballet was something that Oscar Schlemmer created with very strange robot-like costumes. He had like ideas about turning geometry into choreography.
Mm-hmm. I mean, if you go to Stuttgart and you in person see those costumes that they have in the Art Museum of Stuttgart, even now, over 100 years after they were made, they still look really brave and modern and extravagant. I mean, the Bauhaus, you know, a lot of it was a triumph of theory over reality. But then, you know, that's a lot of art. You know, a lot of art comes from theory and conceptualization. And it doesn't always deliver on its theory and its optimism. But, you know, you've got to try. I mean, the reality is, you know, the Bauhaus in itself was, you know, they wanted to try and fund themselves by selling things. But, you know, the manufacturers and the capitalists were skeptical of modern design. So, you know, the Bauhaus themselves, even without the Nazis shutting them down, it was a flight of fantasy. It was always going to crash and burn at some point. It's just the Nazis brought it about quite quickly.
Do you think that the kind of dancing that you're famous for would work within that context, the triad ballet?
If I wore one of those costumes, I'd have to dance very differently.
But, I'd love to see him in one of those costumes, actually.
Let's not talk about bondage outfits now, Paul.
Well, this is Virginia Plain by Roxy Music. Roxy Music, I mean, when we started out, when we were kids, you know, there was only a handful of bands and artists that we actually liked. We pretty much hated everything, which is why we started Orchestra Maneuvers in the Dark. But on that hand, you know, you'd find Kraftwerk, Neu, Roxy.
Velvet Underground,
David Bowie. Kind of it.
Mm-hmm.
Am I missing someone?
No, that's basically it. Yeah, I've got Eno from Roxy.
Yeah.
So we loved Kraftwerk, but we couldn't aspire to have their technology because we were just poor kids from the other side of the river from Liverpool. And one of the things we kind of liked about Eno and Velvet Underground and Roxy Music was they took traditional instruments and they played them in an unconventional way. Mm-hmm. So that's what we didn't even have a synthesizer for the first 3 years of playing together. So we were just using what we had to be as unconventional as possible. So the people that were our heroes in the 70s were the unconventional.
And I think, you know, we really adored Kraftwerk and we thought electronic music was the future. But we weren't necessarily purist about it. You know, we didn't mind using, you know, conventional instruments, whereas, you know, Kraftwerk would never go near. Everything has to be electronically generated. But we weren't that purist, you know.
And Roxy Music, in some ways, is like a connection between Kraftwerk and glam rock.
Yeah.
At least visually. You know?
Yeah, and I'm sure unconsciously, our young selves from sort of the age of 11, 12, 13, we were influenced by British glam rock. T-Rex and Roxy and Slade. You know, we were watching that on Top of the Pops because although we thought we were trying to be very experimental when we started the band, unconsciously we were making really strong melodies as well.
Plain.
Mom
deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
You guys met in primary school. What were your first impressions of each other?
Well, Andy's sort of, what, you're 8 months older than me, and we were in different academic years. So we knew of each other, but you know, when you're a kid, you don't hang around with kids from other years. You hang around with the people in your class. So we knew of each other. In fact, I knew Andy's mum better than I knew Andy, actually.
Because he used to live across the main road in Mells, where we grew up, and my mother was, I think, called a lollipop lady. She had a big round sign and a white coat, and she would stop the traffic to let the children cross the road going to school.
So, yeah. what a lovely name for that job.
Yeah, because she had a big pole with a round head on, like a lollipop.
It looked like a lollipop, yeah.
So Paul met my mother at least twice a day.
But it wasn't really until probably maybe 75, that I spotted. I was kind of, I had friends who had started a school band. They didn't have a bass guitarist. I spotted Andy walking around the town with the bass guitar over his shoulder,
as
one does, you know. I think he just used to have it on his shoulder all the time, just wandering around. I'm a bass player, you know. So I went and knocked on his door and said, "Do you want to join a band?" And then quite quickly we sort of realized that we had more in common musically than all the rest of the guys in the band.
And you started one group called Hitler's Underpants.
We didn't actually start it, did we?
Oh. No. That was some friends of ours who used to get this kind of mad collection of musicians get together once a year to do these crazy gigs. And we were in Hitler's Underpants number 2.
Yeah.
And we only did one gig with them. It was utterly crazy, but quite good fun.
What did they sound like?
Fucking awful.
It was terrible, really, because most of it was made up on the spot, you know. There was hardly any structure to anything.
I read about that project years ago, and then I thought of it when I read in the newspaper that they had auctioned off a pair of Hitler's underpants in the US. He left them behind when he was in a hotel in Austria, right after like the Anschluss. And then he sent off his underpants to dry cleaning or something, and he left them there. And it had his initials written on them. And they sold for $9,200.
What a strange
thing. I'm not sure who bought them.
Yeah, I'm not sure why you would want Hitler's underpants.
Probably Donald Trump.
Yeah, probably.
Was Electricity the very first song that you wrote together?
Yeah, first proper song.
Proper song,
to begin with, Paul actually didn't have any keyboards. He just made weird machines that made noises.
Yeah, because my hobby as a kid was electronics, so I used to make weird and wonderful machines that made noise, but they weren't terribly musical.
You chopped up your mom's radio.
Well, yeah, I had a lot of antis at that time, and there was always old radios in cupboards that didn't work anymore. So I used to go through the cupboards, and once
they didn't work after he got his antis.
Yeah, or I said they didn't work when they actually did, and then I used to just bastardize the parts. You know, I used to take the circuit board because I used to go to the local library and get circuit diagrams of things as well, and you know, I made a Kraftwerkian drum machine. Remember, with the like knitting needles and stuff. And
isn't that what they used to have themselves? Because it looked as if Karl Bartos was knitting.
Yeah, it was homemade.
It was homemade.
And so we didn't have any money.
Paul made one himself,
and we used it on the first album. I mean, yeah. Then we got a cheap organ and an electric piano, and that's electricity is my bass, organ, piano, and the synth melody was the last thing that got written on it, but we had to borrow synths because we didn't own one. In fact, we played 6 gigs as Orchestral Maneuvers of the Dark without actually owning a synthesizer.
Band without a synthesizer.
People tend to forget how extremely expensive synthesizers were in the early 80s. Or late 70s, even more, of course.
I mean, we've often said, though, that one of the things that really changed was, in the same way that guitars and amplifiers started to be mass-produced in the 50s, which led to rock and roll, where, you know, three or four guys could make as much noise as a full band, a full, you know, band with acoustic instruments. Synthesizers in the 60s and 70s were prohibitively expensive, but Japanese companies started to make cheap monophonic synthesizers.
Consumer versions.
And we finally bought one in 1978 from my mother's mail order catalogue. It was £7.76 a week for 36 weeks.
That's how we could afford it.
It sounded bloody horrible, but at least we had a synth.
When you processed it through echo chambers, it sounded good.
I can remember becoming friends with Carl and Wolfgang from Kraftwerk in the 90s, and in fact was fortunate enough to go over there and do some work with Carl. And
for his electric music project.
Yeah, I was invited to Wolfgang's apartment for dinner, and Wolfgang and Carl were there, and Klaus, who also wrote the lyrics and did some of the artwork. In the hot corridor there was a gold record for the song Radioactivity, which had been a big hit in France, and I was standing there sort of out into the blue nowhere. I just said, oh, Radioactivity, yeah, Paul and I love this album, this song in particular. I said, you know, our song Electricity was basically a kind of English punk homage to Radioactivity, and they went, yeah, we know. So yeah, Radioactivity by Kraftwerk, very important song for us.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Did you both go and see Kraftwerk at the Liverpool Empire in 1975?
His mum wouldn't let him.
Yeah, my mum wouldn't let me. She had a strict rule that I couldn't go to a concert until I turned 16. So I couldn't go.
What was she afraid of?
Him giving up electronics and becoming a musician. Oh dear.
Oops. I did anyway.
Yeah, so I went, took the train and the bus. It was a Sunday night as well. So, you know, we had to be at school the next morning. And I went to see it, and it changed my life. And that was really when Paul and I started then spending time round at his mum's house on a Saturday afternoon, in our own cheap way, trying to emulate our kind of German heroes.
I do think that, you know, if we'd had access to Kraftwerk's technology, we probably would have sounded an awful lot more like Kraftwerk, to be honest, when we started, because they were kind of our heroes. But because that was denied to us because we couldn't afford it, I think that's how we created our own sort of unique OMD sound. I think it's kind of...
It was a great relief, actually, I think, quite early on. I don't know when it was, maybe 79 or something. We read an interview with Brian Eno, and he said, listen, you know, if you've got a real kind of junk shop collection of weird and wonderful instruments, well, you know what? They're your instruments. Nobody else will have all of those. So that's your sound. Celebrate your sound. And we went, thank you, Brian. This is our junk shop sound. We will celebrate it.
Yeah, we'll be junk shop Kraftwerk.
It's funny that you became friends with Carl and Wolfgang in the 90s, because I still think that in the first Electric Music album, where you wrote two songs, Kissing the Machine and what's the other one?
Yeah, I know. It was great to work with.
Okay, that album is still tremendous. You know, it's still, I think it's way better, actually, than anything that Kraftwerk has produced since Electric Café. They haven't done a lot.
I think the reality is that, I mean, Kraftwerk changed the world, but then the world kind of caught up with them. And I don't know what the reason is, but you're right. Really, I mean, really, for 40 years, they haven't been able to do anything that has been that important, that radical. And in some respects, and I hate to say this, Ralph's desire to make them into the man machine, to take out the human elements, to make it all machine driven. The prophecy is coming true, but the dilemma is, and I've made this analogy before, is, you know, if you, I love Pete Mondrian and I love abstract art from the 20th century, but these guys didn't have an inkjet printer. They didn't have computers. So they were trying to be abstract and rigid, but they had to do it by hand. So you could still see the hand of the artist.
The humanity.
Still had humanity.
Yeah.
And in the early days, Kraftwerk still had humanity, even though they were trying to be very, very mechanical. As the technology changed and as the humans left the band, it's a bit like drinking water. If you drink a glass of water, it has impurities in it and it gives it taste. If you drink distilled water, it has no taste. And that, to me, is kind of what Ralph has done to Kraftwerk. It's lost the humanity, it's lost the feel, it's lost the taste.
Also, it's difficult to find a theme for a new Kraftwerk album. You know, if they had done an album about the internet in the 90s, it would have come across as... I'm not sure it would have aged that well.
Yeah, the future they were predicting has arrived. It's difficult. And also, you know, they then started changing some of their lyrics to actually the future that they were predicting is now somewhat dystopian. I mean, look at the lyric change in Radioactivity, for example. So I know the difficulty. I mean, listen, you know, us making Bauhaus Staircase, it's really bloody hard after you've made so many albums to think of something new.
Yeah. To not cover the same ground that you've covered before. And I think going back to Kraftwerk, I think Ralph's just kind of... He, he's now creating his legacy.
He's curating the legacy, yeah, definitely.
And I think he's frightened to destroy that legacy with a really crap album. And so he'd rather not try to make a new album than destroy the legacy, you know.
And to be honest, we'd rather him do that than make a bad new album. I would rather go and still see them play Radioactivity and Outer Barn than get up there and play, this is the new album, and everybody goes, oh, God, no.
Have you been to see them since Florian left?
Yeah.
Yeah.
What was it like? Could it compare to, like, the show in 1975?
I think the issue is... You know, you can't see what they're doing behind their console.
There's no performance.
There's no performance.
There's no humanity on stage.
Everything is totally pre-recorded, maybe apart from the melodies that Ralph is playing. The other three guys are up there just mixing the sound and mixing the visuals.
But sometimes when I see them, I get suspicious, and I think that at least one of them is on Facebook.
Yeah, yeah, very possibly.
Just,
you know,
doing the emails or doing the accounts for the night show, you know.
It's just, I mean,
the visuals are spectacular. The 3D show was amazing.
But the problem is, because there's no sense of performance,
yeah,
you just feel like you're going to see a film that you've seen before.
Yeah, and I loved when they did the Computer World tour, when they actually interacted with the audience. They all had their pocket calculators.
Because laptops aren't that sexy, you know.
They're not sexy. Everyone's got one. But they had these little pocket calculators, and they all came down the front and interacted with the crowd, and it was amazing.
I loved the BBC documentary Synth Britannia, where you talk about how a lot of people in the 80s assumed that you had a button that you pressed, and then the machines wrote the songs for you.
Yeah, if only.
Yeah, but we'd be pressing it over and over again.
Yeah,
this was the misconception. It's like, oh yeah, the machines are writing the songs. No, they're not. I mean, and this goes back to a current conversation about AI. You know, are you worried about AI? Is it going to say no? Because AI has to be programmed. You have to punch in a load of algorithms. So it's just copying what it's been programmed. I mean, the programming gets very, very complicated and clever. But effectively, it cannot laterally think. It doesn't have any synapses.
You could argue, though, that a lot of artists work that way. But they just mix up.
A lot of record companies like them to work that way. Yeah. You have a winning formula. Don't change it.
Exactly.
Just repeat, repeat, repeat.
How did you come up with your band name? I always thought that there was some kind of connection to Electric Light Orchestra. But that had nothing to do with it. No,
I mean, it was quite simple, really. We decided, because we were in this band called The Id, and we stopped that band, and we decided to just do it, just the two of us and our electronics and our keyboards and bass and our tape recorder to do all the drums and stuff. So we decided one day that we would get brave and actually just do a concert. We'd played Eric's Club in Liverpool before. And so we knocked on the door and spoke to Roger and said, listen, Roger, you've got your open mic nights on the Thursday night. Can we just come up and play our electronic stuff? We've got a new band. And he said, we didn't expect him to say yes, actually, but he said yes. Yeah, okay, so what are you called? And we went,
You haven't got a name because you thought we'd have to fuck off.
Exactly. So we went straight back to Andy's house. And for some reason, Andy's... Mom and Dad didn't mind him writing on the walls of his bedroom.
That was my notebook, yeah.
That was his notebook.
Yeah, so we just looked on the wall and said, right, we need a name that shows that we're playing songs that our mates don't like. We're not a punk band, we're not a rock band.
So your friends didn't like your music?
Not particularly,
No. They were all into the, you know, like Genesis and the Eagles and things like that. And they weren't interested in anything.
We'd found our alternative in 75, you see, before punk even came along. So
did your friends at least show up for your first concert?
Some of them did,
A few.
There was about 30 people in the audience. But yeah, so we just dared to do our songs our way once, so we could say we've done it.
Yeah, it was really literally going to be one concert.
So we just thought, let's have this preposterous name so people know we're not punk, we're not rock, we're not disco. It doesn't matter, it's only one gig. That was 45 years ago.
It sounds kind of highbrow.
it's just pretentious.
Pretentious is the word. Yeah, we spent a little time on Factory Records because they released Electricity, and we spent a lot of time with Joy Division because we did the Factory Records tours. So I think we sort of fell in love with their music, really, and it did influence our second album, Organization, their music, I think. So yes, Transmission by Joy Division is... it's an important song for us too.
And you opened for Joy Division many nights, but not your nights. First show. That wasn't opening for Joy Division.
No. We got our Genesis myth completely wrong, actually. We remembered that we did our first concert supporting Joy Division, but we didn't, actually.
It says so in many articles.
Our memory was bad. We actually did support... another artist that whose initials were JD, it was John Dowie, who was a comedian poet who was on Factory Records. So, and actually that was the link, because Eric's club already had a reciprocal arrangement with the new Factory Club in Manchester. So when we played Eric's on the 12th of October 1978... they actually liked what we did because we were trying to do something new. And they said, hey, we've got this arrangement. Do you want to go and play in Manchester? And we went, hell yeah, all right. Well, we'll do two gigs, you know. And, of course, we go to Manchester, and that's where we meet Tony Wilson for the first time. And then we get signed to Factory Records.
This was even before Joy Division put out Unknown Pleasures.
This was like November 78.
Right after they changed their name from Warzone. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That's right.
What were they like live back then?
They were still quite punky.
Yeah. Because Martin Hannett hadn't got his hands on them at that
point. Martin Hannett really transformed their sound. I mean, I think that, and I know for a fact that the band, particularly Barney, was unhappy with the sound of Unknown Pleasures because Hannett had basically imposed his vision on their sound. He went, right, I'm going to process the drums, because, I mean, Stephen plays an amazingly strange style, and the processing made it sound very electronic. And then, of course, Hookie's bass is just the driving force. And then Ian's vocals and delivery are the focal point. And so Barney's guitars were just sort of pushed out to the sides. They were like little colours that came in and out. So it was drums, bass and vocals with guitar colours. It wasn't all just like...
He wanted to be sort of punky rock.
But I think once they'd adjusted to what Martin had done, then they kind of adopted that as their sound. So they were a bit more kind of rough and punk in the early days, but they were still amazing. And of course, amazing songs. And Ian and I danced a little similarly with our kind of strange, jerky way of dancing. So, yeah, but there's
definitely some kind of a connection there with them.
Yeah, we played quite a few gigs with them, and it was. Do you know what the funny thing was? Is they were such ordinary, down to earth Northwest guys. You know, they drank beer, smoked cigarettes, talked about football, and liked looking at girls. You know, we all did, but it was just like. They made this music that seemed to be from another planet. And I can remember reading an interview with them, and somebody, some fucking jumped up journalist twat from London, just didn't get it. He was like, you know, they're so ordinary, they're so northern and working class, they surely can't make this great art. And he was just really snotty. But basically trying to suggest that, you know, we don't know where this album came from, but it's not really them. They are playing somebody else's vision here, you know?
They're just northern, you know, lads who get drunk, you know, they can't have designed this amazing sound, you know.
But then, of course, when he, like, commits suicide, there's this whole myth where he becomes this very depressed guy who was so dark, whereas in reality he was probably just someone who...
I mean,
like,
you know,
a lad.
But back in those days, you know, nobody talked about mental health problems and issues. It was like a taboo subject, really. But you know, the writing was on the wall with Ian. You just had to read his lyrics, really, to know.
He had a darkness inside him, didn't he?
But I think.
I mean, obviously, the trigger in the end was this impossible. His impossibility in resolving the fact that he was married with a child.
But he's in love with
fallen in love with somebody else, and it was just, for lack of a better phrase, it was tearing him apart, you know. And in the end, he got very drunk one night and found his resolution, which was very sad indeed.
And Factory Records boss Tony Wilson didn't like take to your music immediately, but his wife did.
Yes, indeed, Lindsay.
She loved electricity and played it in his car.
We'd heard this myth for a while that... We thought it was a myth. But it wasn't until Lindsay came to a festival, not many years ago, was it? Four or five years ago. She came, and so we sort of sat down with her and said, listen, is this true that, you know, our song Electricity, the cassette, got put in a bin bag in the car, and you just pulled it out randomly? And put it on and fell in love with it. And because Tony, I don't think, really got us, initially by seeing us live. But Lindsay heard Electricity and went, you've got to sign this band.
We didn't look very good, admittedly. I mean,
we didn't. I had really long hair. I looked like a hippie.
He looked like Roger Hodgson out of Supertramp, and I looked like some white boy afro hippie, you know.
Peter Saville, the graphic designer at Factory Records, who worked a lot with you later, didn't he tell you to get a haircut?
Mm-hmm. Yes, he did, yeah.
And he was right. He said, your music sounds like the future, but you look like a pair of unreconstructed hippies. You've got to look more like your music.
So we listened to him. We were glad we did.
It's difficult to think of a band that has been so poppy and so experimental, sometimes, you know, at the same time as OMD. And I remember reading somewhere that your record company told you that you could either be ABBA or Karlheinz Stockhausen, that you had to make up your minds.
Well, they said, who are you? Yeah. And we said, well, can't we be both? but you see, this is it. We started with no rules. We didn't have any aspiration. You know, if we wanted to be a pop group, we wouldn't have had such a fucking stupid name, would we?
But I mean, we're quite a schizophrenic band as well. You know, we do, you know, we'll do total pop, and we'll do something very dark and abstract. But I mean, a lot of our pop songs, really, you have to understand that we start everything by an experiment, and some songs will get honed up and honed up, and you know, we've both got this kind of knack of writing a catchy tune. You know,
but you still almost kind of irritated when people refer to you as a pop group.
Well, initially we didn't think we were, and this is the funny thing. Tony Wilson is such a chameleon. You know, one week he's saying to his wife, "Oh, they played the club; they were shit. I hate them." You know, two hairy blokes from Liverpool playing electric nonsense, and then she says, "No, this is a hit." The next week we meet him and you're like, you are the future of pop music. He totally changed his
that
mind.
That was so Tony Wilson.
And all we said was, we're not fucking pop, we're experimental. But little did we know that, we wrote
we
these melodies.
Pop.
I mean, we thought we were being experimental, but we unconsciously we were writing melodies.
Very
as well.
Commercial tunes, you know, which we didn't really realise we were doing.
It didn't sound like pop at the time, but it was going to, a year later, it was going to be the new world dominating English electronic pop music that took over the world.
We've talked a bit about Bauhaus painter Oskar Schlemmer. You've always been really interested in art, and there are many British artists who have gone to art school, but you actually didn't go to art school, which surprises me.
I went to a foundation course. I mean, in a sense, actually, the schizophrenia of the band is mirrored in Paul and I. You know, I was going to do an art degree. and I took a year out. He was supposed to go and do an electronics apprenticeship in London and didn't tell his mother he got the job and took a year.
Yeah, I turned down the job that I got offered. I didn't dare to tell my mother.
Yeah, so I'm the artist, he's music the electronics.
Yeah.
You know, so, but yeah, it's... I only found out a few years ago that if I had gone to Leeds to do my art degree, I would have been on the same course at the same time with Green Gartside from Scritti Politti and Dave Ball and Mark Arman from Soft Cell.
Really?
We all would have been there at the same time, yeah.
I wonder what would have happened then.
Well, yeah, you know, either a super group or a super clash of egos, probably the second. But yes, I didn't go, and we started the band, and I always thought I'd go back, but I never did. And
yeah. So, but your mother must have found out eventually that you didn't.
Well, I
take
only
the
told
and...
her. Yeah, I only told her when we were on Top of the Pops, because because to her, you know, she kind of, you know, loved Top of the Pops as well, and it was just kind of an affirmation of you that you've made it. You know,
you've got to remember as well, the reason why Paul came to live in our suburb of Merseyside was because when he was 2, his father died. When he was 7, his sister died. And his mother basically came to live there because she had family there. Her sisters were living there.
Because yeah, I was born in London.
She had support. Yeah. And so she used to have to work 6 days a week to keep the family supported. That's why we used to go to Paul's house on a Saturday. My house was full of people. We couldn't make any noise. There was nobody in Paul's house because his mum was working. Yeah. So
we used to set up in the back room.
So there. She, you know, she worked her fingers to the bone to raise him, and then the ungrateful little shit turned down a really good job.
A really good job. So obviously, I didn't dare to tell her.
She would have killed him.
She really would have killed me. With her own bare hands around my throat.
Obviously, we remember Bowie when he was all glammy and Spiders from Mars, but our favourite Bowie albums, of course, were the Eno Berlin ones with Low and Heroes, and of course the song that introduced the well, there was a trilogy as well, wasn't it? The third album, which wasn't very good,
exactly.
But Sound and Vision was the first single, and everybody went, whoa, he's changed direction again. Wow. And of course, it was the processing on the snare drum. That was the beginning of the big snare drum. The boosh, boosh. So great, great sound experience.
Love this track, and it's it has a strange effect on me because it stops too quickly. I want more.
Yeah,
you know, there are many Bowie songs that kind of, especially on that album, that go on forever, and this one just stops. Mm-hmm. And you need like another chorus.
yeah well, he must have decided that was enough for that, but I mean, I think you're right, it is too short. It's a great song.
Did you get to meet him, Bowie?
Never.
No, unfortunately. Never. He was supposed to, not too many years before he actually passed, he was supposed to come to one of our shows in New York, but sent a message that he couldn't make it because Iman was dragging him to a charity event instead that night. So I was hoping that would be the chance to meet him, but alas, not.
One of your first hit singles was Enola Gay, which was named after the plane that dropped the bomb over Hiroshima. When it came out in the 80s, the Cold War was still going on, and you know, people still had this fear of nuclear war, which kind of disappeared in the 90s. But now, when I listen to it, I can still feel this shiver. You know, because the nuclear war is not completely abstract anymore.
I was reading in the paper this morning, actually, that Putin is apparently quoted as saying, "The Americans won't retaliate if we use nuclear weapons." So you're just starting to worry now about this. You know, yeah, it feels like we're back in the Cold War brinkmanship. It's frightening. Yeah. So yeah, I mean, you know, we toured in the 80s. We drove down the corridor from West Germany through to Berlin and saw all the tank traps and the soldiers. And it was, yeah, you know, it was very edgy, and you did think that there was a serious possibility that there would be a nuclear war that wouldn't last very long and it would just absolutely destroy civilization. It didn't happen, but it's not over yet.
So those themes were, you know, we touched on a lot on the Dazzleships album. It's very much about the Cold War, the whole record, really.
Your most experimental record.
Yes, definitely. Mm-hmm. It almost destroyed our career, but yeah.
More Stockhausen than ever.
Definitely far more Stockhausen than ever.
But you've played that album in its entirety.
We have, yeah. We did it. We did several shows. We did a couple of nights at the Royal Albert Hall, and we took it to Germany, didn't we?
Yeah,
and played.
I mean, it just goes to show that, you know, that Andy Warhol was right. You know, that if you are more than 15 minutes ahead of the fashion, you're in trouble. Because you listen to that album now, and it doesn't sound that fractured.
It doesn't sound that difficult.
Yeah. But just in 1983, it was just a little bit ahead of the fashion.
Like many other teenagers in the 80s, I kind of discovered you through the movie Pretty in Pink.
All right.
Where If You Leave is played in the final scene when Molly Ringwald goes to the prom. Is it true that If You Leave was written because John Hughes, the director, changed the ending of the movie after a test screening and needed a new track?
Yeah, the thing was, we'd written a song for it, spent quite a long time writing the song. And we recorded it in the UK, and we took
which track was that?
A song called "Goddess of Love," And we were just about to start an American tour, so we went a couple of days early to mix this song in LA, and so we landed, and there's a message because, you know, no mobile phones or anything then. So there was a message at the hotel to call John Hughes, and so we contacted him, and he said, "Listen, sorry guys, but your song doesn't work anymore because I've changed the whole ending of the film. Can you write us a new one?" And we were like, "You're kidding, John. We all our equipment's gone to San Francisco and we've only got a couple of days and you want us to write a really important track for the film?" And he said, "Look, I'll hire you anything you want. You can go into Larrabee Studios, amazing studio, and see what you come up with." You know, so we were really like flying by the seat of our pants. In fact, it's the only song we've ever written, because we didn't have any instruments, any synthesizers. It's the only song we've ever written, I think, where I'm hammering out on the piano and Andy's next to me writing words, and we kind of wrote it.
It was like being in the Brill Building, yeah. I was standing next to the piano and Paul was trying chords because we were waiting for some higher equipment to arrive. And so off the top of our heads in one day, we wrote this song and put a cassette on a motorcyclist, take it to Paramount about 2 or 3 in the morning, and we wake up the next day to be told, "Yeah, he loves it, go and finish it." And we're like, "Fuck, we're so tired." Oh, okay.
But it's still a jet lag as well. We don't just got off a plane. Yeah.
So yeah, it was totally, totally made up on the spot, but it worked.
I mean, 9 times out of 10 you do that, you write a piece of crap, you know, but we just got lucky that it was actually a half-decent song we wrote.
The Brill Building is an interesting reference because, you know, a lot of your melodies kind of remind you of classics from the 60s, even like Bacharach songs.
Mm-hmm.
But they're in a completely different context.
I'll take that
context,
as a compliment.
Yeah, we're big fans of Bacharach. So,
I mean, you know, we're not purists in the sense of, you know, that we won't reject every tradition, we won't reject every sound. It's just we get excited by something new that inspires us and we go off down a different road. We just try to avoid what we see as just cliches that have been repeated too many times. So Enola Gay is a classic rock and roll chord sequence.
There's a song on your new album called Verushka where you reference classic movies like Pierrot Le Fou, The 400 Blows, and Sunset Boulevard. Is the title, does it have a connection to Verushka von Lehndorff, the actress and model.
Influenced.
It's influenced by influenced. Okay.
Yeah. Paul gave me a piece of music years and years ago that just had a working title. It was just called Verushka.
Because I've been watching film noir. There was a film noir season at a cinema in London, and I was with Claudia Brooken from Propaganda at the time. We used to go and watch these film noir tracks, and so I just started a track for her, really, with the chords. And
you had a project together.
Yeah, we had this band 1-2 together, and we were thinking about making a new album, second album.
But Verushka wasn't in any of those movies that you mentioned in the song. She was in Antonioni's Blow Up.
Yes.
Yeah, I mean, the whole thing went full circle. So Paul sent me the piece of music. I didn't get the reference to film noir. I started writing a song. I wrote the chorus, couldn't come up with a verse for like 2 or 3 years. And then I Googled Verushka, just to see if I could get some inspiration from the internet. And I come up with the model, actor, Verushka, and the fact that she'd made one of the last kind of film noir movies. And I just went, film noir? Oh, yeah, I can just paint verbal pictures of film noir scenes. So the first verse is just visuals like, you know, headlights on a rain-soaked road and another stranger falling through the night. And then the second, references... actual film noir movies, and of course, obviously, as well, there's the Swan Song Madness, referencing Sunset Boulevard. Gloria Swanson played the mad. Gloria Swanson played the mad old crazy actress. So the Swan Song Madness is also a reference to Sunset Boulevard. So it was, the whole thing kind of went completely full circle.
I met Verushka at this party in New York once.
Oh, wow.
There's really? There's this British magazine called Dazed and Confused, and they had a party in New York in the fall of, I think it was 1999, and she was there. So I spoke a little bit to her, and she was...
What was she like?
She was talking about, oh, New York is so boring. It's so boring. And I was totally excited, because I was in New York.
New York,
there were all these rock stars, and we were in the, you know... the skyscraper with a great view, and she was just saying, oh, it's so boring here. But then she told me about her father, who was a part of the plot to kill Hitler with a bomb in 1944. Right. And he was executed, I think. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, he was.
Yeah.
He was a count.
Colorful family life. Yeah,
quite a family.
It feels as if you two complement each other really well. You're the extrovert one, and you're a bit more reserved.
Yeah.
I think you once said that if two Pauls had a band, they wouldn't get much done. And if two Andys had a group together, they would kill each other.
About right.
About right, yeah.
Is that why you've stayed together for so long, even though you broke up for a little while?
Yeah, we broke up for a while. But
I mean, we recognise that what the other does well fits into the things that the other doesn't do. So we, you know... I mean, there are times when we bang heads and we bang together and we drive each other totally mad.
Yeah.
But when it works very well.
Yeah, when it works brilliantly well, I think.
One of many groups that you've influenced is Depeche Mode. I heard somewhere that Electricity basically made them start to make electronic music.
Yeah, well, Vince heard Electricity on the radio and he went out and bought...
No, it was in a club.
Was it in the club?
In Basel,
in the club. But he went out and bought Electricity and flipped it over and listened to Almost, and Almost really spoke to him. And so he decided he was going to go out and buy a synth, and so he went, because he was a guitarist, really, Vince. And he went out and bought a synth, and the first song he learned how to play was Almost, and then decided that he shouldn't be in a rock band, he should be in an electronic band, so...
And then you toured with Depeche Mode in 1988 in the US. I once read this insane story about how you met their road crew. And there was some guy who popped out his glass eye.
That story got out.
And dipped it in cocaine and put it back in.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was possibly the weirdest thing I've ever seen in my life to this day.
I haven't even heard of anyone who's done something like that.
It was true.
It was his way of ingesting the drug.
Speaking of drugs, why don't you introduce Waiting for the Man by
One of the very few cover versions that we ever did, and our version was very, very different to theirs. But we love the Velvet Underground. I mean, Lou is a great lyricist, and again, they were another band that taught us that you don't have to have a load of expensive, fancy equipment. You can play conventional equipment really weirdly and make your own sound.
Still do something interesting.
And so, I mean, the Andy Warhol, Banana Velvet Underground with Nico is still to this day one of my most played records. It's absolutely beautiful.
The last OMD show that you did together was at the Rose Bowl, where Depeche Mode recorded their 101 live album, and they did a movie as well. What was that evening like? Thomas Dolby was on the bill as well.
He was, yeah. It was actually still one of my favourite all-time gigs, but it was terrifying because, I mean, there was, I don't know, 70-something thousand people there. It was people as far as you could see. The sun hadn't gone down properly when we went on, so you could see all the faces, and that was pretty terrifying. And then we walk on stage, and there was like a spike on the mains, on the power. And Martin and I were playing these digital emulator things, and the spark in the mains had made them restart.
They booted from disk.
They booted from disk, and it just, as soon as we were about to start Enola Gay, Martin and I both saw this sign that says, "This will take a while." And we're like, okay, there's 70,000 people here, and I've got "This Will Take a While" on my keyboard.
But we carried on playing, so yeah, the first verse was basically a dub bass and drums version of Enola Gay, and then finally the keyboards came back in again.
Is that why you dance so much? Because there's a YouTube clip of Enola Gay at the Rose Bowl, mm-hmm. and I've rarely seen you move so much with the guitar. You're like doing Michael Jackson moves.
I was just full of adrenaline and shitting myself, to be honest.
Adrenaline coming out.
Yeah, it was terrifying. It was terrifying.
But wonderful too.
Yeah.
If You Leave was a hit at around that time. So, people really knew us as well. They weren't just there to see Depeche, you know. So, we had this crowd going crazy. It was really amazing.
And then that YouTube clip ends with you like running off stage, and you, Andy, you say, "It was terrible. I never want to do it again." Very jokingly, I think. And yeah. Paul says that it was really good fun.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But that was your last show together for a very long time.
For a while, yeah.
For a while.
Yeah,
about 17 years.
Yeah. Yeah. And when you got back home, you found out that you still owed your record company money. You must have had the worst deal ever.
Yeah, basically.
We did have the worst deal ever.
Yeah, I mean, everybody
along
thinks...
with other Yeah,
everybody
Virgin
thinks
artists.
Richard Branson is this cheerful, entrepreneurial, lovely, you know, the kind of acceptable face of capitalism. But no, I mean, he was a ruthless businessman, and the deals that we and other Virgin Act signed were barely legal. So, yeah, for all the record, millions of records we sold, we weren't making much money. We toured and toured America, losing money, trying to break America, and as Paul always said, it kind of broke us. And, we got back from that Depeche Mode tour, and they'd earned enough to retire, and we'd got ourselves another about $350,000 in the hole because we weren't earning that much money. And
how do you lose money touring?
Oh, in those days, you used to. Everybody did. It was the flip side of how it is now, because the records made you ship piles of money. Well, it should have if you had a right good deal. You know, we didn't, but that's where the money generated. And going out on the road, ticket prices were very low, and you would regularly get tour support from your record label because it was so expensive. No one really turned a profit touring.
Yeah, I mean, the one thing that's really changed is if you look back, 40 years, a record, an album cost £3.99 and a concert ticket cost £3.99. Now, if you don't download and you buy a record, it's maybe twice that, to say, £8, £9, £10. But a concert ticket has gone up 10, 15 times. So concert income has followed inflation, but purchasing music has been suppressed really by the digital revolution, because once music became digital, people just didn't see that it had a value.
It's like water from a tap.
Yeah.
It's always there.
Surely it's free.
It's almost exactly. free. Yeah.
The other thing you got to remember, the difference between us and Depeche was, you know, we signed a deal which had terrible royalties, and every penny we spent had to be taken back out of our royalties. And we were on a very small royalty, whereas Depeche Mode did a thing called a 50-50 deal. So after all the costs were paid for,
profit share deal.
It was a profit share. So, you know, we were on 11% with all of the costs coming out of our percentage. Depeche Mode were on 50% with, once the costs were shared, they would get 50% of the profit. So they were earning so much more money than we were. I mean, listen, we didn't get into the music industry to make a profit, but you cannot run a band if you don't have money. And yeah, we'd sold millions of records, and we get to the end of 1988, and our manager says, "You owe Virgin Records £1 million."
Yeah, which was insane. And so the only way we could balance the books was to do a greatest hits album, which we did. Is what we did next. You know, we did, and that sold quite a couple of million. So
paid off the debt.
So that paid off the debt.
I have a few questions from my listeners, and not just any listeners, but the brave souls who support this podcast through Patreon. God bless you all. First off is Sebastian Elfors, who writes, "I went to Andy McCluskey's hometown Mells, outside Liverpool, and I found the phone booth that OMD sing about in Red Frame, White Light. In the song, they mentioned the number to the phone booth, 632-3003, and the phone booth still works. OMD were in the pub nearby, taking calls from fans and promoters who wanted to book them for shows. We also met an elderly couple who used to babysit Andy when he was little. Please tell me more about the phone booth and your childhood in Mells."
Yeah, you know, this goes back to the days when neither Paul's mother nor my parents had a phone in the house. So
that was the nearest phone box to our houses.
Yeah, it was the nearest phone box. So everything we did, if we needed to call our manager, the record company, phone up Sounds or the NME to get in the gig guide, that was our office. Everything, every phone call made was from that telephone box. And so we you know, in the spirit of Kraftwerk wanting to write about technology and things, and it was our piece of technology. Our second single was Red Frame, White Light. And of course, the downside of it was, I didn't mention the area code, which would have been 151 for Liverpool. So unfortunately, a lot of OMD fans started phoning 632-3003 in different area codes. And there was one poor woman in Edinburgh had that number, and she threatened to sue our record company because she got so many phone calls from OMD lovers. And then, of course, about 5 years ago, British Telecom, nobody uses phone boxes anymore, British Telecom took it away. And all the OMD fans went crazy. The local council went, "Oh shit, what have we allowed them to do?" And it came back, and it was turned into an OMD museum.
So it's now a museum. It's one of the smallest museums in the world. But
you can go in. It's got things in it. The glass has been painted by John Petch, who's done two of our recent sleeves. And you can dial. You pick up the phone and dial, and you can hear me talking about the history of OMD and the telephone box.
Amazing. Yeah. Here's a question from Mark Starhill. How does Andy manage to dance so much on stage despite his age? Does he have any tips for staying in shape?
I go cycling and I go to the gym and I swim. I'm not as in shape as I would like to be because I've been ill for most of the last month. So last night, the first night in Oslo, was hard work. I'm pacing myself. But yeah, you just... you stay fit, you get fit. I mean, my biggest problem is I don't have any cartilage in my left knee, so I start every tour with my favourite rock and roll drug of choice, which is a cortisone injection.
It's better than dipping your glass eye in cocaine.
I think at our age, definitely.
Here's a question from Jonas Hellberg. Do you have a favourite synthesizer?
That's a good question, actually. Because, you know, we've always kind of gone with the technology of the time. We've moved with the technology of the time. So I think the Korg Micro Preset 500, just because it was the first synth we had, and it enabled us to become a synth band. So,
but don't buy one because they sound terrible.
Yeah, they sound terrible. Yeah, but I have a fondness for that synthesizer.
Because the crazy thing is now is that we don't use any of the originals, and the purists hate us for it. We use it. It's all in the box. We use virtual synths because they sound the same, and you don't have to take notes and MIDI them all up. And so, you know, when you switch off and you go, you know, Kleptocracy version 2.9, you come back next week or next year, everything's exactly where you left it. So
you'd have to save patches on your physical synthesizer and then go, which patch was it? And then it doesn't sound the same.
I think if I was to choose one, I'd probably say either a Roland SH-1 or a Jupiter 8.
Magnus Dunberg asks, are there any new artists or bands that influence you?
I think we're always listening. You know, we don't live in a bubble. We're always listening to music. So we're all always soaking things up.
One thing hasn't changed from early days is we still don't like most music we hear.
Yeah.
It doesn't talk to us. So when we do like something, we get very excited. Now, right now, we're lucky that we have an amazing support band called Walt Disco, who are playing the whole tour with us. And they are exciting because they're walking that tightrope between being quite weird and experimental, very unique their own way, but they still write great tunes. So we're loving having them with us.
And a little bit retro as well. They're a little bit.
Yeah, there's a bit of glam rock in there.
There's a bit of glam rock and a bit of Bowie.
And they have
a very
glam rocky image as well.
Yeah, they do. Yeah. And
let's listen to one of their tracks.
David Bowie.
Obviously, you know, you can't go wrong if you have a listen to How Cool Are You?
How Cool Are You, yeah.
Deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
He has a very melodramatic voice.
Billy McKenzie meets David Bowie.
Yeah, there's a bit of Billy.
So, yeah, we love them. Yeah. Robin was brilliant when she went electro. XX, Hot Chip. Tiny Magnetic Pets, love them. My first
Atom TM.
Single... Oh, yes, Atom TM, of
Atom
course.
TM,
yeah,
Uwe. Uwe Schmidt.
Who helped do production on two of the tracks on the album, actually. My first single I ever bought, and people go, oh, you're an electro boy, why did you buy that so emotional, such a big ballad, is Harry Nilsson's version of the song Without You. It's just so emotional. It's a really beautiful, powerful, sad, emotional song. And I still have a soft spot for really, really emotional songs. And so, again, if you're thinking about newer Artemis, and she's not that brand new now, but, I mean, Lana Del Rey is just... And the song Love is just... Oh, it melts.
Look, you kids with your vintage music coming through satellites while cruising. You're part of the past, but now you're the future. Signals crossing can get confusing.
And Lana Del Rey is also a fan of Harry Nilsson. She even mentions him in one of the tracks on the latest album.
There's a connection
and
there,
it all
yeah.
sounds like film noir soundtrack, doesn't it?
Yes.
Yeah, it does.
In the song, Did You Know That There's a Tunnel Under Ocean Boulevard, mm-hmm. she sings about the song Don't Forget Me by Harry Nilsson,
oh, okay.
where after 2 minutes and 5 seconds, there's a moment where it sounds as if he has completely destroyed his beautiful voice with drugs and alcohol. So she sings about how she wishes that she could go on a ride through LA at night with John Lennon and Harry Nilsson in the back seat.
Okay.
Great idea, great image.
You mentioned that Bauhaus Staircase might be your last album, but will you keep going to be able to celebrate your 50th birthday in 4 years?
I mean, you never know, do you?
We're not saying we're going to stop being OMD. We're just not sure we can make a whole new studio album.
Yeah. There may be other projects we do together, you know, but I can't, because, you know, we take... You know, we're sort of 5 years between albums, really. So you know, in another 5 years, do we really want to be? You know, we're not getting any younger. We're in our heading to our mid 60s
no
now. Yeah. So
you know,
I mean,
also,
do we have the energy to?
If you look
to,
at like Depeche Mode or The Cure or even like you too, they're all in their 60s.
Yeah, so. The bottom line is, we will not release anything if we don't think it's good enough. As Paul likes to say, and he's right, you know, we don't release a new album because we need a new logo for the tour t-shirt.
We do it because it's because we love what we do, and we you know, we've made something that we want to share with the world.
But you've had really nice looking logos, so at least you could go on tour if you have a new logo for the tour t-shirt.
There's always a reason to go. We can find a reason to go on the road without it being a new album, you know.
Yes.
There's always an anniversary these days of something that mm-hmm. we've done, you know.
And we're all doomed anyway because of climate change or nuclear war, so, you know, maybe you should keep touring.
Well, you know, I mean, that's
as long as it's fun.
That's what the song Anthropocene is all about. So, we just don't know. We just don't know. I mean, listen, we can't believe we've been a band for 45 years when we got together to do one gig. So you just don't know.
Yeah. I mean, as long as we've got the energy and the will to do it, we'll do it, you know.
Speaking of death and the end, I read this interview with you, Andy, where someone asked you about your biggest fear. And people usually say, like, cancer or, you know, something happening to your loved ones. But you replied, getting stabbed and bleeding slowly to death. It was so very specific. I couldn't help laughing. What, mm-hmm. Has someone tried to stab you, or is that just a...
Not yet.
Well, thank God.
I've thought about it a couple of times.
I'm sure he has. No, you know, you just... you just don't know, you know. It's something that, you know, somebody's asked me specifically for a fear, a phobia. I thought it was, you know, and so, you know, it's just, it's not a nice way to go. So, you know, it's a beautiful, happy ending to our interview, isn't it? Thanks for listening, guys. Have a lovely day.
Thank you for coming to my home, OMD.
Thank you, Frederick.
Thank you for decades of excellent music, and... good luck tonight.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Den här podcasten producerades av Daniel Bäckström för Leon Media. OMD var hemma hos Dragan.